This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, Star by Star by Troy Denning. Read for you by Alexander Adams. The dark sliver of a distant starliner crept into view, a blue needle of ion efflux pushing it across the immense sweep of a brilliant orange sun. Like a million such suns in the core region alone, this one lacked any world with a civilization or even a sapient species, and it was too inconsequential for any name except an obsolete Imperial survey number. With so much emptiness, so many planets untouched, it seemed to Jaina Solo that there should have been no need for fighting, that there should have been room for all. But comfort was always easier to steal than to earn, peace easier to break than to keep, as her mother so often said. And so the Yuuzhan Vong had invaded a galaxy that might have welcomed them with open arms. It was a mistake the aliens had yet to understand, but one day, Jaina knew, one day the Jedi would teach them. Jaina's reverie was interrupted by a sudden sense of deep disquiet. An unexpected stirring in the Force that soon built to a strange feeling of frenzy. She opened herself to it further and experienced an instant of terrible longings and ravenous hunger, not quite evil, but dark and feral, and brutal enough to make her gasp and withdraw from its touch. Catching a glimmer of movement in the canopy reflections, Jaina glanced at an activation reticle in the front of the Jade Shadow's cockpit. A small section of plexalloy opaqued into a mirror, and she saw the willowy form of Mara Jade Skywalker slipping onto the flight deck. Mara's cascade of red-gold hair was a tangle of sleep snarls, but her complexion was no longer quite so ashen, nor her green eyes quite so sunken. Jaina stood and, feeling a little like a child caught with her hand under the candy dropper, turned to vacate the pilot station. Mara waved her down. "Sit, you're entitled." She dropped into the navigator's chair, sweetening the filter-scrubbed air with a hint of talc and stericlean that seemed to cling to her even with her new baby thousands of light-years away. She lifted her chin toward the distant starliner. "That are two troublemakers?" "The transponder identifies it as the Nebula Chaser," Jaina said. R2-D2 plugged into the droid station and confirmed the identity with a chirp. "But there's been no rendezvous signal, and a moment ago I felt something... strange in the Force." Mara nodded. "It's still there, but I don't think it's our passengers. It doesn't feel right." "Nothing feels right about this," Jaina said. A 1,000-meter Corellian cruiser with a customized Horsch Kessel sublight drive, the Nebula Chaser had already traversed half the face of the orange sun. It was now the size of Jaina's finger, with a blue efflux tail three times that long. "They still haven't signaled. Maybe we should give them one more orbit, then duck behind the planet and blow ions." Mara shook her head. "Luke's right about these two. They're getting people killed with their saber flashing. We'd better snag them while they need the ride." She pulled her crash webbing over her shoulders and clipped the buckle. "But let's be ready. Power up." Jaina reached over to toggle the ion drives active, but stopped when R2-D2 whistled an alarm. The heads-up display holo contorted through a maddening array of colors and shapes, then settled on the image of a tiny tube-shaped craft swinging toward them well beneath the luminous haze of the sun's orange corona. "That explains their silence," Mara said. Jaina whistled softly and glanced through the tinted canopy, where the new arrival's speckish silhouette was streaking up behind the Nebula Chaser. "Looks like a frigate analog," Jaina said. "What do you want to do?" "The only thing we can..." There was a note of caution in Mara's voice that would have seemed foreign to her before Ben's arrival. Damp down all systems and wait. On board the Nebula Chaser, the Rar sisters stood shoulder to shoulder in front of the off-bridge vid console in Captain Pollux's private quarters. Their long headtails, Leku, writhed nervously as they watched a large piece of Yorick coral detach from the frigate and start toward the Nebula Chaser. Pocked and lumpy, the smaller craft looked more like a mined-out asteroid than a boarding skiff, but the sensor displays showed the heat signatures of at least 100 warriors inside. There was also some other creature, larger and colder, but the sisters needed no sensor readings to know this. When they reached out with the Force, they could feel the same hungry presence that had touched them as the frigate appeared from behind the sun. Whatever the Yuuzhan Vong were bringing across, it was attuned to their galaxy in a way its masters would never be. Alima isolated the creature's heat signature and asked the computer to find a match, then turned to see Numa already at the captain's bunk laying out their disguises. A pair of diaphanous dancing shifts, some face paint, and not much else. Having spent the last year leading a fierce resistance movement on the occupied world of New Plimpto, the sisters were certainly the object of the boarding party's search. Fortunately, their enemy would be searching for a single human woman instead of two Twi'lek dancing girls. In their role as the resistance leader, they had taken the precaution of never appearing together and always in disguise, with their Leku hidden beneath the cowl of a Jedi robe. By the time the sisters changed out of their jumpsuits and returned to the vid console, the Yuuzhan Vong were disembarking in the docking bay. With bald, sloping brows and saggy eyes rimmed underneath by drooping blue membranes, they were half a head taller than a typical human, and much heavier. Their brutal faces had been reshaped into leathery masks of disjoined cartilage and torn flesh, and their powerful bodies were adorned with religious tattoos and ritual disfigurements. Most wore shells of living Bonduan crab armor, and all carried the ubiquitous Yuuzhan Vong amphistaff, a serpent that could change on command into a razor-sharp polearm or poison-fanged whip. The most hideous of the warriors, a stoop-shouldered brute with only dark cavities where there should have been a nose, pushed arrogantly past the guards surrounding Captain Pollux.
"You have Jedi aboard?"
"No," Pollux lied smoothly. "Is that why you stopped us?" The warrior ignored the captain's question.
"You come from Tarfaglio, or Sikoria?"
"You can't believe I would tell you that," Pollux said. "The last I heard, our whole galaxy was at war with you." The retort drew a grudging sneer of respect.
"We are only a picket ship, Captain, and you are carrying refugees. You have nothing to fear from us, provided you tell me now if you have Jedi among your passengers."
"We have none." Pollux did not look away when he answered, and his voice did not crack. Even civilian starship captains knew the Yuuzhan Vong were blind to the Force. "Feel free to search." The warrior cracked a smile.
"But I do, Captain. I do."
He glanced toward his boarding skiff and in his own language ordered,
"Duin Turvoxin."
A seam appeared near the back of the craft and began to open, the Yorick coral puckering outward like a set of pursed lips. A pair of yellow oval eyes appeared in the darkness, and Alima felt the hunger in the Force grow more distinct. Then, when the aperture had opened a half meter, an ebony streak shot from the portal and clattered to the deck in a ripple of darkness.
"Clouds of fire!"
Numa gasped. The creature, the Voxen, Alima guessed from what she had learned of the Yuuzhan Vong language, began to pad around the deck on eight bandy legs. Though it stood no higher than a human waist, it was more than 4 meters long, with a flattish head and an undulating body covered in black scales. A line of coarse sensory bristles ran down its spine, and a white barb protruded from its flickering whip of a tail. The beast circled the captain and his wary guards only once, then went off toward the rear of the docking bay. In the vidscreen, Pollux fixed his gaze on the Yuuzhan Vong warrior. "Why have you brought that thing on my ship?" The warrior knocked Pollux to the deck with a backhand slap.
"You can't believe I would tell you that,"
he laughed. Though Pollux's guards did not appear in danger of attacking, the captain signaled them to stand down and return to his feet with as much dignity as possible. Alima activated a surveillance lock on the Voxen, and for the next hour she and Numa watched it roam the Nebula Chaser's primary activities deck, occasionally circling a petrified refugee or cocking its head at some eruption of machine noise. Finally, it leapt into a decorative water fountain and began to circle the statue of a Calamarian star urchin, its sensory bristles on end and its yellow eyes fixed on the ceiling. With a drooping feeling, Alima turned to the holopad and called up a three-dimensional schematic of the Nebula Chaser. After a few adjustments, it grew clear that Captain Pollux's cabin was directly over the creature, 10 levels above.
Unpleasant, Numa said. The tips of her leku flicked sharply. It seems to have an idea of our location. That makes no sense.
Alima reached out with the force and felt the same hungry stirring as before, but now much stronger and distinctly below.
Unless it's using the force to track us.
A shudder ran down Numa's leku, and she glared at Alima out of the corner of a slanted eye.
You do have a way of springing to the most alarming explanation, sister.
Alarming, but no less likely.
Alima pointed to the vidscreen, where the Voxen was bounding down the corridor toward the nearest lift tube. Numa studied the image for a moment, then said,
You seem to have a point.
Alima saw at once what her sister was thinking.
We'll pick our escape pod on the way.
The sisters left the captain's suite and scurried toward the opposite end of the officer's deck. At the lift tube, Alima consulted the data pad and found the Voxen splashing through a damp deck basin 2 levels below. Its yellow eyes were fixed on the ceiling, tracing their path.
It knows we're moving, Alima said. But its sense of distance is poor.
Numa was ever the optimist.
Where are we going?
Alima called up a display of midship escape stations, then chose the one most directly opposite the Yuuzhan'vong frigate.
Engineering deck, bulkhead 42.
She performed a sectional security scan and found a team of Yuuzhan'vong smashing a droid in gravitational control.
We'll have to trick a squad of scarheads.
The sisters started toward bulkhead 42. As they advanced down the corridor, they peered into each room they passed and called loudly for someone named Travitt. When they reached inducer control, a Yuuzhan'vong warrior stepped out to confront them. With only 3 long scars on each cheek and a single disfigured ear, he was clearly a warrior of low rank. The sisters pressed themselves against the corridor's far wall and, doing their best to look shocked and repulsed, started to ease past. He blocked their way with a lowered ampostaff.
Where do you go?
To see Travitt?
Numa made her voice sound frightened and tentative.
He works in the coil room.
The coil room?
The Yuuzhan'vong echoed. Alima shrugged.
His workstation.
A second Yuuzhan'vong, with a crooked nose and scar-laced face of a minor officer, stepped into the corridor. He scrutinized the sisters briefly and, seeing there was no place beneath their dancing shifts to hide a lightsaber or anything else, pointed back the way they had come.
This ship is under seizure. Return to your berthings.
Numa and Alima put on looks of fear and confusion and remained where they were.
We can't, Alima said. They sealed off the staff deck, Numa said, and they closed our lounge. See?
Alima called up a schematic of the ship and shoved the data pad at the officer.
We don't have any place to go.
Do not pollute me with your profane devices.
The officer knocked the instrument from Alima's hand and smashed it beneath his heel. Alima stepped to her sister's side and eyed the ampostaff blocking their way. The subordinate looked to his officer, who scowled and waved him down the corridor.
See to it and return.
Not waiting for the warrior to lead the way, the sisters slipped past his ampostaff and started down the corridor. The bulkheads appeared to be simple structural arches that spanned the passage every 10 meters, but each one contained a thin durasteel door that would descend automatically at the first sign of a pressure drop. The doors could also be triggered by voice. As they scurried down the corridor,
Alima reached out with the force again and felt the Voxen behind them, on the same level and coming fast. They were at bulkhead 38, still 90 meters from the escape pod. Alima's palm ached for her lightsaber. The faint clatter of claws on metal echoed down the corridor behind them. She looked over her shoulder and saw a distant ripple of darkness bounding down the sterile tunnel. They passed bulkhead 42. Numa turned toward the outer wall and slapped her palm against the escape bay door pad.
Attention! You have requested entrance to an escape pod launching bay.
The computer spoke in the same cheery female voice it used to announce dinner seatings.
Are you sure you wish to proceed?
Yes, Numa said.
If you proceed, an alarm will sound in the security...
Override alarm. Code Pollux 816, Alima called. Confidential departure.
Override accepted.
As the launching bay's iris hatch swirled open, the Voxen came scurrying down the corridor, sensory bristles on end, white tail whipping back and forth. The creature's yellow eyes were fixed on the floor, and it was licking the air with a long forked tongue, and Alima's hand ached more than ever for her lightsaber. Ready the escape pod, Numa ordered, pushing Alima into the launching bay's bluish light. Now, sister. Alima found herself looking into the nozzle of the escape pod's primitive rocket engine. It was barely a meter across, just large enough to start the 100-person capsule toward the nearest habitable planet. In the corridor, Numa called, "Close bulkhead 42. Authorization code, Nebula Rubentine."
"The bulkhead emergency code is temporarily suspended,"
the computer returned in its sweet voice.
"Please report valid emergencies to any engineering supervisor."
"Override," Numa ordered, "and disarm safety sensors. Code Pollux." As Numa finished the authorization code, Alima slipped past the rocket nozzle to the side of the pod. A sickening crunch sounded out in the corridor, but she could no longer see what was happening outside the bay. She pressed her palm to the escape pod's activation pad. The hatch slid open, revealing a starkly lit interior crammed with 10 cramped rows of acceleration chairs. There was no cockpit or viewport, only a droid pilot stationed at the craft's single control panel. The droid pointed to the chair farthest from the door.
"Welcome to escape pod 421. Please take your seat and wait for the other passengers. There is no need..."
"Prepare for a cold launch." Lima would have preferred the speed of a hot launch, but the flare of rockets would be noticed on the bridge. And however faint their fast dwindling hopes of escaping unnoticed, she still had to try.
"On my command. Authorization code Pollux." "The override authorization code has already been given," the droid said, turning to its duties. "There is no need to repeat the override authorization code once the launching bay is entered."
A wet burping noise sounded from out in the corridor. Then Numa screamed. Alima stepped out of the escape pod and saw her sister staggering into the launching bay, arms raised to cover her face. She missed the center of the hatch and stumbled over the rim, then fell with her feet across the threshold. Her face and chest were covered in sizzling brown mucus, and her leku were thrashing against the durasteel floor.
"Sister!"
Alima sprang toward Numa and saw the Voxen pinned beneath bulkhead 42, struggling to pull itself forward. Though its torso was pressed almost flat, she was astounded to see it moving at all. Bulkhead doors had safety sensors precisely because they closed with so much force. They had sensor overrides because it was sometimes necessary to crush anything beneath them to save the ship. As Alima neared her sister, the creature swung its broad snout in her direction and sprayed a jet of brown saliva through the hatchway. Prepared by the attack on her sister, she opened herself to the force and, with an almost unconscious wave of her fingertips, sent the stream washing back toward her attacker. The Voxen, fast as a blaster bolt, closed its eyes and turned away before the mucus struck. Alima grabbed her sister beneath the arms, smearing her own fingers in the burning mucus, and tried not to think about what the stuff was doing to Numa's face and eyes.
"Find your center, sister."
She pulled Numa into the launching bay.
"Let the force flow into you."
Numa fell completely quiet, her mind alarmingly calm. And then the calmness vanished, leaving in its place only a lingering peace and a vague sense of emptiness. Alima cried out and started to look down, then felt the mucus burning into the bones of her fingers,
and knew she did not have the courage. Alima carried her sister's body around to the escape pod hatch and glanced back toward the door, where the Voxen, still trapped beneath the bulkhead, continued to watch. One side of its head was covered in the residue of its acid mucus, the scales beneath pocked and smoking as they continued to dissolve. The heads of several amphistaffs appeared in the narrow gap next to the creature's head and began, hopelessly, to pry. Alima looked back toward the hatchway.
Close launching bay.
The Voxen's snout, all of the creature Alima could still see, turned toward her and opened half a meter. A deafening shriek filled her ears. Then the fist of a powerful compression wave slammed her in the stomach. She suddenly felt dizzy and sick, and in the next second, she was slumped against the escape pod, cradling her sister's dead body in her arms. She felt something warm trickling out of her ear and touched it with a fleshless finger. When she lowered her hand, the tip of the bone was red with blood. Still holding Numa in her lap, she kicked her way through the escape pod door.
Launch!
Alima gasped.
Launch now!
The pod hatch closed, the lights dimmed, and that was all. The capsule remained eerily silent and still. Puzzled, Alima dragged herself past a row of acceleration chairs and looked forward. The droid pilot was facing her, vocabulator flashing rapidly as he endeavored to explain proper launching procedure. Alima could not hear a word.
Override, she yelled. Authorization code?
The escape pod shot forward, hurling Alima into a Durasteel chair mounting. She had already given the authorization code. Jaina missed the launch. She was staring at the heads-up display, trying to bring the Shadow's comm array into perfect alignment with the Nebula Chaser's Type Beam antenna. Mara kept her attention fixed on her navicomputer. Look at this. She keyed a command, and a golden trajectory line appeared inside the canopy. It ran from the Nebula Chaser more or less across the Shadow's bow, then curved sharply toward the planet. An escape pod? Jaina glanced back to the Starliner and found the Yuuzhan Vong frigate still sitting idle off the chaser's docking bay deck. They endangered thousands of refugees, then snuck away in an escape pod? Jedi did that? That's how it looks, doesn't it? Mara began to plot an interception course. Let's pick them up before they do any more damage. A mere kilometer beyond the transparisteel wall, the antenna-strewn horizon plunged away into a bottomless abyss of tumbling asteroids and drifting stars. Tiny blue halos winked into existence and slowly swelled into the backlit rectangles of enormous cargo barges returning with loads of Durasteel from outlying fabrication plants. On the way in, Han Solo had counted nearly 500 warships under construction in the old Bilbringi shipyards. Clearly, young General Muin was a Sulliston with a plan, just the sort of careful desk pilot who always impressed Coruscant Command, and seldom failed to exhaust Han's limited supply of patience. Wishing he could use one of those Jedi calming techniques his son Jason was always talking about, Han forced an insincere smile and turned toward the center of the room. Leia sat on a small couch with the General, her face glowing with the same stunning brown-eyed intensity that had caught Han's eye so long ago.
100,000 lives are at stake, General, she was saying. The Vray are a gentle species. Without an escort, the evacuation convoy will be defenseless against the Yuuzhan Vong.
And how many lives will the New Republic lose if Bilbringi falls before the fleet is completed? Muin asked.
His heavy Sulliston jowls rippled gently as he spoke, but his feelings remained otherwise hidden behind his flat mask of a face.
Whole worlds will perish, and that will mean millions.
She's only asking for 20 ships, Han said.
I'm sorry, no.
Muin shook his head and started to rise. A buzz sounded from the secure comm station on the general's desk. C-3PO raised his head and inquired, Would you like me to take that for you, General? Muin nodded.
Unless it's urgent priority, I'll reply in a few minutes.
Thanks, 3PO, Han said. Any interruption would only reduce their chances of getting the escort. He dropped into a seat opposite Muin.
You seem to be forgetting who you're talking to, General.
Leia's brown eyes flashed in alarm.
Han, it wasn't so long ago she could have demanded the ships, Han continued. If anyone deserves...
I know what the princess deserves.
Muin reluctantly returned to his seat.
Excuse me for interrupting, C-3PO spoke again, but there is a Yuuzhan Vong emissary asking to see Princess Leia.
What?
What? Han and Leia asked together.
Tell him no, Han said.
He wishes to discuss the fate of some refugees.
No, Han said.
Leia flashed him a scowl, then said to C-3PO,
Tell him I'll send instructions shortly.
Have you gone space sick?
Han knew he would never win this argument, but he had to try. Having already lost his best friend to the Yuuzhan Vong, he was determined not to lose his wife.
Or maybe you've forgotten Elon and the BOTUS attempt, or how close you came to losing your legs last year on Duro?
I haven't forgotten, Leia said evenly.
She turned to C-3PO.
You may relay to the Yuuzhan Vong that we will grant him safe passage.
Han and Leia's two Nogri bodyguards spent the next 2 hours converting one of the base's old Imperial interrogation chambers into an interview room he considered safe enough for his wife. The main safety feature was the transparent steel panel through which the discussion would be held, but there were also the biosensor arrays to monitor the Yuuzhan Vong's body state, the negative air pressure to confine any poisons he might release to the original room, and a void button that would open the chamber to the near vacuum outside. C-3PO announced the emissary's arrival, then a dozen guards entered the interrogation chamber with their charge. The Yuuzhan Vong had been afforded few diplomatic courtesies. Something that looked like an artificial eye had been confiscated and now rested in a security officer's hand, and in place of his own clothes, he wore a thin fleet watch cloak with the hood up. In his hands, he carried a sponge-like creature that resembled the villips Yuuzhan Vong used to communicate over long distances, though this one was larger and more gelatinous. The escorts pushed the emissary into the room's single chair, then left and locked the door. Leia stepped to the transparasteel.
I am Leia Organa Solo.
Yes, we have met before on the planet Romamul.
The emissary's voice was throaty and arrogant, and it instantly caused Leia's face to go white. He set his creature on the table and peeled back his hood, revealing a smashed Yuuzhan Vong face with one empty eye socket.
And at Duro, we even worked together for a time.
Kree-Ar?
Leia's hand dropped instinctively to her lightsaber, the one Luke had made for her years ago. The War Master Tsavong La had destroyed her other lightsaber on Duro.
Nomanor.
You have an excellent memory.
The Yuuzhan Vong glared at Leia coldly.
How is your son Jason? And Mara, is she still in remission? As you know, I have a special interest in your sister-in-law's condition.
Han felt the void button tickle his palm and realized he was dangerously close to pressing it.
Keep talking, fella.
During the fall of Duro, Nomanor had attempted to kill Mara and Jaina, tried to orchestrate the deaths of Leia and Jason, and before that he had infected Mara with a deadly disease that had required more than 2 years to overcome.
There's nothing I'd enjoy more than vacuuming you.
Nomanor's smile remained snide.
Before you hear what I came to say. Besides, I do not think Leia Organa Solo the type to break a promise of safe passage.
Without asking permission this time, Nomanor coaxed his creature awake with a brief stroke.
Tsavong La wishes you to see this.
The creature melted into a flat disk, then began to glow with yellow bioluminescence. The light coalesced into a long starship with a blocky stern and the distinctive hammerhead bridge of one of the Corellian Engineering Corporation's large civilian cruisers. Judging by the lack of efflux from the ion drives and the open doors of its docking bay deck, the ship was standing dead in space.
The Starliner Nebula Chaser, Nomanor said. The image is current.
Han's heart leapt into his throat. The Nebula Chaser was the ship Mara and Jaina had gone to meet. The mission was supposed to be simple, a quick rendezvous in a safe sector, and then home. But something had clearly gone wrong. He put on his best Sabacc face and forced himself not to look in his wife's direction. "Very impressive," Leia said. Though she had to be just as worried as Han, her voice remained dry and mocking. "You've learned to transmit holograms. I'll look forward to your holodramas on the net."
"The Yuuzhan Vong have made living light for centuries,"
Nomanor snapped.
"I am showing you this ship because the War Master thought you might wish to trade."
"Here it comes," Han thought. He moved his hand away from the void button, not trusting himself to resist if Nomanor announced the Yuuzhan Vong had his daughter.
"Tsavong La thought wrong," Leia said.
Her voice was a little too cold, the only hint of the ice ball that had to be filling in her stomach.
"I'd rather trade with a hut."
"The huts do not have what you want."
Nomanor stabbed a claw-like finger into the hologram.
"There are 10,000 refugees aboard, and their peril is your doing."
"I doubt that. If this is what Tsavong La wished me to see, our business is done."
Leia turned her back on Nomanor and stepped away from the Transparasteel. It was all Han could do not to remind her that their daughter's life might be at stake, but he held his tongue, knowing she was only trying to undermine their opponent's confidence. She made it as far as the door before Nomanor called,
"You can save them."
He rose to peer over the living light.
"Just tell me where to find the Jedi base."
Leia glanced at Han, clearly wondering whether Nomanor meant they could save the refugees or Jaina and Mara, then said, "There is no Jedi base." Nomanor sighed theatrically.
"Princess Leia, you discredit me again in the eyes of Tsavong La."
He let his chin slump.
"I advised him you would never sacrifice so many to save so few. But he believes you are willing to sacrifice more, much more, to protect the Jedi."
As Nomanor spoke, a salvo of plasma balls streaked into the hologram and erupted against the shieldless starliner, opening flash-melted holes in the Durasteel hull. Dark clouds of speck-sized flotsam and atmospheric vapor began to jet into space, and another salvo of plasma boiled into view. Many of the balls entered through the same holes as the previous fuselage and tore through the ship's interior bulkheads. The clouds darkened as more flotsam poured into the cold vacuum. Then the image shifted, magnifying the breach area and revealing the specks to be the tumbling, pressure-ruptured bodies of the ship's passengers.
"Truly, the wisdom of Tsavong La is as boundless as the galaxy itself."
Nomanor rolled his one good eye as though sharing a joke, then gestured at the starliner.
"They are dying because there were Jedi aboard. If the Jedi do not want more to die, they will surrender within one of your standard weeks."
"More?"
Han knew it was exactly the question Nomanor wanted him to ask, but he could not restrain himself. He had to know what had become of Jaina. "How many more?"
"Your scouts will confirm that our fleets have surrounded the world of Talfaglio. For the next week, all refugee ships are being held in orbit. If the Jedi surrender, the convoy will be allowed to leave. If the Jedi do not, it will be destroyed."
Nomanor glanced down at Han's hand, which was hovering over the void button, then added,
"As they will, if I fail to return."
"You expect the Jedi to surrender?" Han asked. He was too relieved by Nomanor's failure to mention Jaina or Mara to feel any real outrage at the deaths of 10,000 strangers. Maybe he should have felt guilty about that. He didn't know. But all that mattered at the moment was that Jaina and Mara were safe. "Won't happen, fella. I might as well get things started." Han locked gazes with Nomanor and lowered his hand toward the void button, grinning crookedly and taking his time to give Leia a chance to stop him. The Yuuzhan Vong met his gaze with a sneer and did not look away, even when Han's palm touched the button. He paused there, waiting for Leia to stop him, but she said nothing. Han glanced over and saw her glaring at the emissary, her brown eyes burning with raw rage.
What are you waiting for? She demanded.
Really? Leia nodded.
Do it.
Han pushed the void button, and the seal hissed open along the edge of the ceiling panel. Nomanor's one eye grew wide.
Are you mad?
He jumped to his feet.
You'll kill millions!
Leia reached over and depressed the void button again, stopping the ceiling panel where it was.
Not us. You.
The air continued to hiss out of the chamber, causing the image of the nebula chaser to flicker out of existence as the billet creature curled in on itself. Nomanor glanced at the ceiling, then back to Leia, his gruesome face slack with surprise. She waited until he pressed his fingers to his ears, then hit the void button again. And closed the panel. When Nomanor took his hands away from his ears, Leia said,
Go back to your War Master and tell him how you were treated. Tell him the Jedi accept no responsibility for the lives he threatens, and that any emissary issuing a similar threat will not be returned.
Nomanor nodded. If not meekly, then at least not haughtily.
I will tell him, but that will change nothing.
He went to the door and waited until it opened, then added,
The War Master believes this will work. He has not been wrong yet.
Luke Skywalker knew that a few days in the Bacta tank would heal the physical damage, but there was an anguish in Alima that would never fade. He could feel it even now, while she floated in a restless healing trance, and the torment would only grow worse when she awakened to the news of the Nebula Chaser's fate. The infirmary door whispered open behind Luke, and he turned to find Silgal's liquid eyes studying him from the threshold.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Luke, but your brother-in-law is demanding to speak with you. He seems to think we're keeping something from him.
Luke smiled. Good old Han. It's nice to have him back to normal. Silgal's huge mouth parted in a Calamarian grin.
Yes, isn't it?
Luke entered the conference vault and found his nephews, Jason and Anakin, waiting with Danny Kui, Tahiri Vela, and a group of other Jedi. A small hologram of Han and Leia hovered above the holoprojector in the center of the conference table. Han frowned. You heard about the threat? Luke nodded.
A few minutes ago. That was quite a demonstration Nomanor put on, Leia said. 10,000 people dead, and I doubt he would have stopped if I had told him where to find Eclipse. What are we going to do about Talfaglio?
First, remember that by allowing the Yuuzhan Vong to make the responsibility ours, we would only be playing into their hands, Luke said. We must always remember that they're the murderers here, not us.
That is true as far as it goes, Master Skywalker, Silgal said,
addressing Luke more formally now that they were in a larger group.
But I am not comfortable closing my eyes to the death of so many. Whether the responsibility is ours or not, we must do something if we can prevent it.
And we're not entirely innocent in this either. Jaina entered the vault leading R2-D2 and several Jedi. News of Tsavong La's threat was spreading fast, and base personnel were pouring into the conference vault.
There were Jedi on the Nebula Chaser, and those Jedi were leading the resistance on New Plympto. The Rar sisters put the whole Starliner at risk by boarding it, as we did by rendezvousing with it.
Anakin Solo, his brown hair as unruly as ever, stepped forward to kick the discussion into hyperdrive.
Look, it doesn't really matter whether we're responsible or not. There are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of lives at risk. We've got to do something, that's all.
What would you have us do, Anakin? Luke asked. Tahiri answered for him.
Break their blockade, of course.
Blonde and willowy, Tahiri resembled in many respects a 15-year-old version of Danny Kui, even down to having been a Yuuzhan Vong prisoner until Anakin rescued her from a Shaper laboratory.
We make them pay so they don't try it again. It's the only way we turn this back on them.
And that may be exactly what the Yuuzhan Vong expect us to do, Danny said. If they see the Jedi as warriors like themselves, they will expect an honorable response.
Han nodded in the hologram.
They're calling the Jedi out. You'd be fools to go, especially when they're waiting for you.
So we let a world die?
Jason's quiet voice was a stark contrast to the rising tension in the room. He turned toward Tahiri and Anakin.
But waving our lightsabers around will only get more people killed, too.
Anakin scowled, as he so often did when talking with his older brother these days.
Maybe you can just stand aside and watch.
Jason raised a hand.
Let me finish, Anakin. I'm saying that neither choice is good.
He glanced at the others in the room.
If we fight, the Yuuzhan Vong kill more people. If we don't fight, they kill them anyway. We can't permit either. The Jedi are supposed to be the defenders of life in this galaxy.
What are you saying, Jason? Han demanded. That the Jedi have to surrender? He closed his eyes and winced.
Tell me that's not what you're saying.
Nobody is going to surrender, Han, Luke said. He was sympathetic to Han's concern. Of all the young Jedi Knights who had come to Eclipse, Jason was the most philosophical, often struggling with the paradoxical idea that it was sometimes necessary to destroy in order to preserve. Luke knew his nephew's concerns to be the result of a disturbing vision on the planet Duro, in which Jason had seen the galaxy tipping toward darkness and been unable to stop it. Fearful of tipping the balance even farther, the young Jedi had temporarily abandoned the Force altogether, though he had resumed its use when events necessitated it in order to save his mother's life. Jason remained uncertain enough about his vision that at times his uneasiness still moved him close to inaction. We're not surrendering, Luke repeated. He turned to the others, now numbering nearly 50, including Mara, their infant son, Ben, and more than a dozen non-Jedi support volunteers. Our path is not yet clear, but I am confident in this much. It would be folly to let the Yuuzhan Vong draw us out before we are ready. One of a thousand pagan blasphemies excluded from the redemption of Obroa Sky, the Museum of Applied Photonics rose above the surrounding bug yards in a glittering massif of transparasteel towers and crystal plaque galleries. Nomanor's escorts led him through a maze of corridors profanely lit by wandering balls of pure light. They found Savang La in a chamber surrounded by what looked like 100 kilometers of snarled translucent threads. A fully tattooed warrior with fringed lips and bone-implanted armor, the War Master was holding a small holopad in his hand, gazing at its projector disc with a look most others would reserve for cowards and slaves. Now, he said into the instrument. Savang La had barely spoken before an instantaneous flash lit the whole thread tangle, then leapt through the empty air into the holopad. A millisecond later, the full-sized image of an infidel X-Wing appeared over his hand, obscuring the War Master's upper body and much of the room. The starfighter turned slowly toward the door and opened fire. Only Nomanor did not duck for cover.
Do you know what I would do with this, were I the infidels?
Savang La asked, speaking from inside the hologram.
Destroy it, I am certain, Nomanor answered. Such lifeless things are an abomination to the gods. I cannot tell you how it disgusted me to abide them while I prepared the way for our invasion.
We all do what is necessary, Executor, and you have already been commended for enduring the enemy's filth.
Savang La's tone was irritated and perhaps a little distracted.
We cannot defeat what we do not understand. For instance, our coral ship pilots could easily be misled by an image such as this. Were I the enemy, the galaxy would be littered with these devices.
The galaxy is littered with them, Nomanor answered, bristling. They are not really much to admire, Great One. They are as limited in their capacities as are our enemies.
The X-Wing vanished. Then Savang La dropped the holopad to the floor and crushed it beneath the armored Vuasa claw that he now stood upon in place of the foot taken by Jason Solo.
The enemy has proven challenging enough to thwart you several times.
The War Master's voice was full of loathing. A true believer in the supremacy of the Yuuzhan Vong gods, he disavowed the influence of chance and viewed any failure as a sign of the instrument's spiritual decadence.
I trust that was not the case this time.
Your meeting with Leia Solo went well.
Very well. It would have been unthinkable to answer anything else.
I have no doubt that the Jedi will respond to our challenge.
You are more confident than I would be in your place,
a wispy voice said, low and behind him.
The Jedi will smell our trap and be wary.
Nomenor turned and saw a motley featherball hopping past the guards on thin, reverse-jointed legs. Her willowy ears and corkscrew antennae bestowed on her a vaguely moth-like aspect, though Nomenor considered her a pest more on the magnitude of a redank.
Bergier, he fumed.
I was not aware you knew the ways of the Jedi.
Bergier knows them better than I,
Tsavang La said.
She was the one who said the Jedi would let you live. I believed they would kill you outright.
You were perhaps closer to the truth than your pet.
Nomenor refused to call Vergère an aide, for the peculiar little creature was no more than the familiar of an agent who had perished during an ill-fated attempt to disease the Jedi. She had become an advisor to Tsavang La after a brief captivity in the hands of New Republic Intelligence, where she managed to learn as much about the enemy in a few weeks as had Nomenor in all his years as an agent provocateur. Questions had been raised about her loyalties, but once the reliability of her information had been established, she had quickly become Nomenor's greatest rival.
Leia Solo and her consort did attempt to kill me as you expected,
Nomenor continued,
but I was able to play on her human emotions to save my life.
So now you can control the emotions of the Jedi?
Vergère mocked.
Then perhaps you should make them surrender.
One can lure a Tana into the spatter pit with a smile and soft words.
Nomenor spread his hands and turned to Tsavang La.
Even I cannot persuade it to lay its neck in the cleaving yoke.
The War Master rewarded him with a curt nod.
I am more interested in what Leia Solo said than why you are still alive. How did she respond when the gift of anguish destroyed the infidels?
She wanted to kill me.
But she did not, the War Master observed. What did she do instead?
I convinced her she would also be killing millions of refugees.
Even Nomenor realized he was clinging to the claim a little too closely, perhaps because of the shame he had already suffered at Leia's hands on Duro.
She yielded.
Not yielded. She refused to accept blame.
Vergère stated her rebuttal as fact, not supposition. She hopped over to Tsavang La.
She's been a diplomat all her life. For her to fall into such a trap would be akin to you flying into an ambush.
Tsavang La considered her argument for only an instant.
It may appear so, but something else is happening.
He looked over Vergère's feathery back at Nomenor.
She let you live for a reason. What is it?
The answer, of course, was because she had given her word, but Nomenor knew better than to say so.
Before she released me, she gave me a warning. She said to tell you that the Jedi accept no responsibility for the hostages, and that any emissary you sent with a similar threat will not be returned.
If Tsavang La noticed the slight contradiction of Nomenor's contention that he had been the one controlling Leia, he showed no sign. He simply looked to Vergère.
Right again, my servant.
She smiled up at him.
Have I not said the Jedi will prove worthy foes?
You have indeed, the War Master said. But the refugees will be their undoing yet. They will become the wedge that drives the New Republic away from the Jedi.
The door opened to an unfamiliar stuffing sound, and Silgal's skin went dry. Silgal was not taking chances, not with creatures that spat flesh-eating acid and stunned their prey with sonic blasts, creatures whose blood became a neurotoxin in most kinds of air, whose toe pads harbored 100 deadly retroviruses. She was too fatigued to analyze the situation, too prone to mistakes lately to gamble with the lives of everyone on Eclipse. Silgal backed quietly out the door, then
then slipped the comlink from her pocket and raised it to her lips. A plaintive Wookiee groan rolled out of the room, and she grew aware of a strange heaviness in the Force. With a start, she realized the sound she had heard was crying. Human crying. Silgal peered through the door and saw a line of young Jedi standing on the other side of the room, looking through a transparasteel observation panel into the frozen tissue locker. At one end of the group stood Anakin, tall, lanky, and broad-shouldered in the way of human males as they crossed from adolescence into adulthood, recognizable even from behind by his sandy brown tousled mane. Beside him, as always, stood Tahiri, small and svelte, with short-cropped blonde hair, feet customarily bare, her EV footwear in one hand and Anakin's arm in the other. The Wookiee groan had come from the opposite end of the line, where russet-furred Lobaka stood with Jaina Solo's slender form wrapped into his hairy arm. Next to them stood Zek and Tenel Ka. Zek, a wiry young man with shaggy black hair hanging over his collar, Tenel Ka, a tall and willowy beauty with rust-colored hair and an arm amputated just above the elbow. And more or less in the center was the one Silgal had heard crying, blonde-haired Raynar Thull, standing alone with his fists pressed against the transparasteel, his shoulders rising and falling as he sobbed. Silgal started to back away, but her presence had not gone unnoticed. Tenel Ka turned and fixed a pair of red-rimmed eyes on her.
"Do not mind us," she said. "We are not here to disturb your work."
Feeling the companion's anguish through the Force, but unsure of what to do about it, Silgal entered the room and went to the closet where she kept the cryosuit she would need to collect her samples.
"Someone else has died?" she asked, fearing the truth even as she surmised it.
"Lusa," Anakin said, voice cracking.
Lusa was one of their close friends from the Academy on Yavin 4, a nature-loving female from the planet Chiron. Anakin gestured vaguely toward the frozen carcasses in the tissue locker. A pack of Voxen ran her down. Silgal felt a stab of guilt.
"I am sorry to be so slow. I have learned much about these creatures, but nothing of use."
"Don't these Voxen have a weakness?" Tahiri asked. "The Sand People say everyone has a weakness. Everyone except them."
"They have no weakness I have found," Silgal answered. "As we suspected, the Voxen are part of this galaxy and part of the Yuuzhan Vongs, but I have not gone far beyond that.
There is so much that makes no sense."
"You are tired."
Tenel Ka came over and held one of the suit's bulky arms.
"I will help you."
"Maybe she should rest." Anakin turned around, revealing eyes as red as Tenel Ka's. "It's hard to think straight when you can't even stand." Silgal smiled at his concern.
"You're right, of course, but I cannot bring myself to sleep while others are dying."
She pushed her arm through the second sleeve.
"I may as well work."
"Is there anything we can do?" Tenel Ka asked. "We have sentry duty in an hour, but—"
"You can watch," Silgal said. "You can tell me how I keep contaminating these samples."
"Contaminating them?" Tahiri asked. "What do you mean?"
"Their genetic codes always map the same," Silgal said. "It's not the equipment. I have checked, so I must be contaminating the samples when I collect them."
Tenel Ka exchanged glances with her friends, then laid a hand on Silgal's arm to stop her from closing the suit.
"How many times have you tried?"
"4, Silgal said.
"And they always map the same?" Jaina asked. "Exactly the same?" Silgal nodded, struggling to see what the young Jedi were driving at.
"We are making a systematic error somewhere."
"And what if you are not?" Tenel Ka asked. A wave of weariness came over Silgal, and she shook her head.
"We are. No two genetic sequences are identical. There are always differences."
"Not always," Jaina said. Silgal frowned, then felt her skin brighten to a pale green.
"Clones?"
she gasped.
"They're cloning the Voxen."
"Why would they do that?" Tenel Ka asked. "Would it not make more sense to breed them?"
"Perhaps."
Silgal was suddenly wide awake, her thoughts flying at light speed.
"Unless they have only one." Anakin's eyes lit with excitement. Or perhaps it was determination. That would be a weakness, definitely.
With the milky splendor of the galactic core pouring down through its transparasteel ceiling, the crater room on Eclipse was one of the few that still had light. An attempt to feed more power to the central cooling system had blown a primary switching bank, shutting down all non-vital systems and compelling the Jedi to hold their assembly in one of the Eclipse program's labs. Han and Lando Calrissian stood a little off to the side with Leia's Nogri bodyguards. Leia was near the front with Mara, Silgal, and the older Jedi, while Jason and Jaina stood with Tenel Ka, Loey, Raynar, Zek, and the more thoughtful of the younger Jedi Knights. Anakin, with his friend Tahiri at his side, was surrounded by his growing gaggle of companions, now including three Barabel hatchmates, Ulaha Kore, a red-haired human woman named Errol Besa, and the Twi'lek, Alima Rar. Silgal was the first to break the silence.
"I asked Master Skywalker to call this meeting because I wanted to give you some hopeful news. Instead, I must again apologize for my tardiness in solving the problem."
The Mon Calamari turned her bulbous eyes toward the floor.
"Forgive me."
"Don't think like that." Though Anakin's eyes were wet with barely restrained tears, his tone was warm. "No one could do better. Without you, we wouldn't even know these things were part Vornsker."
"That's right," Ganna Rysoad agreed. The big man's scarred cheek lent a dangerous air to an otherwise rakishly handsome face. "Everyone knows how hard you've been working, just by how hard we've been working." This drew a chorus of agreement, for Silgal was keeping many of the Jedi busy trying to identify the location of the original Voxen, the Queen, as they now called her. Meanwhile, Anakin and his group rushed from planet to planet, retrieving Voxen corpses for Silgal, who plotted dispersal patterns and correlated data. The result of all that effort had been to confirm that all Voxen were indeed clones of a single creature.
"My friends," Silgal said, "I discovered something very interesting in that last Voxen retrieved by Ulaha and Errol."
She tipped her head toward the pair, both standing with the flock of young females that always seemed to gather around Anakin these days.
"In its stomach was a full-grown Isalamiri, and in the Isalamiri's stomach were several Olbio leaves."
"So these things eat Isalamiri?" Raynar asked. "Is that what you're telling us?"
"No, Silgal is telling us where to find the Queen," Jason said.
"You ran a metals study on the leaves?"
Silgal smiled.
"A perfect match. The leaves came from Merkur."
Lando let out a low whistle, and Han drew a disapproving glance from Leia by expressing his emotions in a less eloquent fashion. Merkur was famous among smugglers for the high metal content of its trees, a trait that rendered orbital sensor readings unreliable and made the place perfect for secret bases. Under the best of conditions, it was hardly an ideal place to go Voxen hunting, and the task was bound to be complicated by the fact that it lay about 400 light-years behind Yuuzhan Vong lines. The room fell eerily silent. The question before the group was as obvious as it was pressing, and the Jedi were well enough attuned to each other to realize their next task was making a plan.
"Let us dismiss any thought of a massive attack out of hand," Ulaha Kore said. "Even if we could assemble a large enough fleet, and we cannot, our probability of success is below single digits."
"And the mere attempt would telegraph our intentions," Luke said. "We must think of a better way."
"A commando force," Zek said. "We sneak a small strike team in the back way."
"Not unless you're better at it than Wraith Squadron," Han interrupted. "They've been trying to penetrate the frontier between Corellia and Vortex for 6 months. The Yuuzhan Vong have Dovin basal interdictors everywhere. The Wraiths were pulled out of every hyperspace lane they tried."
"Then we have to fool them," Anakin said, speaking in his typical tone of teenage certainty.
He turned to the younger Jedi gathered around him.
"The Yuuzhan Vong want us to surrender, right? So we do, and let them ferry us across the frontier."
"Go on," Luke said, deftly drawing attention back to the assembly's more mature side. "We're listening."
Anakin disengaged himself from Tahiri and stepped toward his uncle.
It'll buy time for Talfaglio, too.
That would be a plus, Luke said.
How do we do this?
You don't, Anakin said. We do. Han felt Lando's hand on his arm even before he realized he was starting forward, then stepped back and quietly thanked Lando for the reminder to hear his younger son out.
Anakin looked back to his group. We'll have a traitor turn us over to the Yuuzhan Vong on the pretext of buying time for the Talfaglian hostages. We'll set up a transfer for somewhere near Obroa Sky, let them cross the frontier, then take over the ship and fly to Merkur.
He turned to his older sister.
I know Wedge, General Antilles, has let you fly a couple of captured Yuuzhan Vong vessels. Can you teach Zek?
Jaina studied him suspiciously.
Why would I need to? You're not doing something that crazy without me.
A look of distress came to Anakin's face.
But you're only on temporary leave. The rogues could call you back any time.
Sure they could. Jaina rolled her eyes, then her face grew hard in the same way Leia's did when she would abide no argument.
If you go, I go.
Me too, Tahiri said. Anakin frowned.
You? You're too... If you say young, I'll kick you where you really don't want to be kicked, Tahiri interrupted. Nobody here knows the Yuuzhan Vong from the inside like I do. Can anyone else, except you maybe, be sure they'd know a Shaper laboratory? Can anyone else understand the language?
Good point, Jaina said. We'll need her help to run the ship. Anakin frowned at his sister.
Can you fly a Yuuzhan Vong ship or not?
If Wedge just had you put on the cognition hood or something.
I've flown, and so has Tahiri, unless you've forgotten, Jaina said.
She was referring to Anakin's narrow escape in the Yagdul system a few months before, when along with